What is going on? It is Crypto Bobby. Hope you are having a great day, great night, wherever you are watching or listening in from. And yes, today the virus is indeed spreading. Had a chance to sit down and talk to Anthony Pompliano, aka Pomp, in regards to a number of some of the more pressing topics or hotter topics really in the crypto world right now. The Bitcoin ETF, digital securities or security tokens, accredited investor status in the U.S., really just the entire industry as a whole, a recent investment him and his team, Morgan Creek, made in Cityblock Capital and a number of other components. Really think you are going to enjoy this discussion with Pomp. So let's take it away. Thanks so much for taking the time, Pomp. Really do appreciate it. Let's kick off today with a quick just softball question here. How refreshing of a break was it to step away from Twitter for a minute and all the things that were going on there?
Yeah, I mean, look, Twitter is one of the best tools, I think, that are out there. It is crazy to me how engaged and large the audience I have is. But when I took the break, I just said, look, you know, I'm just going to take a break. I have no clue how long I'm going to be gone for. And everyone was joking with me. I had so much free time, right? Like, you don't have so much time you spend on these things until you take a break from it. And frankly, I fully am a believer in, you know, digital addiction and all that stuff, because I really, you know, really had just a cleaner head and mind when you're not just staring at a screen all day. But I came back on Friday the 13th, which personally thought was hilarious, and then enjoying being back, and you can't stay away, right? It's just a great marketing tool. It's a great audience. It's a great way to get information, etc. And so happy to be back.
Is it any coincidence that the Bitcoin price somewhat rebounded the second you came back on the scene as well? It can't be coincidental.
So all these people keep sending me these charts of, like, I came back and within, you know, hours or days, the price started recovering. I wish that I was narcissistic enough to believe whatsoever. But I tend to think that, you know, hopefully this bear market is at least kind of paused and we'll see a recovery for a whole bunch of different reasons other than, you know, one guy coming back to Twitter.
For sure. And so one thing that, I mean, speaking of Bitcoin, everybody right now seems to be talking about the Bitcoin ETF or the potential for a Bitcoin ETF. And I think you recently wrote or published it on Medium, an open letter to the SEC regarding the Bitcoin ETF from yourself and kind of the rest of the team at Morgan Creek. Would love for you to maybe talk about your thoughts on the Bitcoin ETF and kind of why you wrote that letter as well.
Yeah, look, I think the ETF is a really important milestone when it comes to the crypto industry, right? And so if you look at kind of historically what happened when a gold ETF was implemented, right, you just get a kind of a big rush of institutional capital. And it's for a couple of reasons. One, there's reduced friction, right? But two is also there's like this stamp of approval, where people are saying, hey, look, there's institutional grade custody, there's accounting, there's sometimes insurance, all these things that go along with kind of a more professional product that's been approved through the ETF process. And so I think that that's, you know, that important milestone. One thing to call out that I did not know until recently is that in the commodities world, actually a index ETF was approved before a single asset ETF. And so Bitwise obviously just filed to a crypto. It'll be really interesting to see not only when is an ETF approved, but which one is approved, right? Is it a Bitcoin ETF? Is it, you know, some other digital asset ETF, or is it an index? And so I think that, you know, ultimately at some point it's going to get approved. I don't think it's going to be, you know, over the next 60, 90 days. Obviously we wrote a letter trying to, you know, compel regulators to at least see the argument that the ETF makes the market more mature, safer, you know, and gives kind of access to a global audience. I don't think that they are necessarily going to move just because, you know, a couple of guys on the internet wrote the letter. it was important to kind of put our, you know, thoughts down on paper and kind of take a stand publicly on what we thought, you know, was the best path forward.
Totally. And just looking at some of the like past ETFs and maybe this round, is there anything, I think there are, you know, some people that are kind of comparing, you know, some of the past ones to what we have in place now, or some of the applications we have in place now. Do you feel like we're, you know, maybe in a better position than we were the first few times around in regards to some of these applications, where maybe like the infrastructure is a little bit better? You had mentioned insurance as well and some of those components. Do you feel like maybe just generally speaking, infrastructure wise, we're better positioned to see some level of maybe increased interest and an approval from regulators?
Yeah, look, I think the infrastructure takes time, money, and talent, right? And so more time has passed, right? I think there's more money coming in terms of the companies that are building the infrastructure. And we're seeing more and more people who are coming from the legacy financial system come over and continue to lay that infrastructure. And so, you know, take somebody who's built ETFs in the legacy financial system, and now they're going to go and they're going to build it in the crypto world. Really, what they're doing is they're not building a new type of ETF. They're building the same exact product. It's just the asset is different. Right. And so the more that we can get those people to come in and spend time with the crypto assets, I think that you get a better product. Right. And part of that is better infrastructure. And so as more and more of these applications come, I think that they're only going to improve. And I was telling some of the guys at Bitwise, like, it's just like we're knocking at the door. Right. Yeah. And the more applications that are there, it's just more people knocking. And at some point they have to let them in. But they're only going to do that when they have high level of confidence in the infrastructure, in the safety, the regulatory environment, and the legality, you know, all of this stuff. And so we're definitely better today than we were yesterday. And I think, you know, tomorrow will be even better. And so, you know, just have patience, I think.
For sure. And one thing you had talked about kind of outside of the ETFs recently was digital wallets being like the new brokerage accounts. I think that's like an interesting point. And I think there's a lot of people that, like, speaking of infrastructure, trying to build, high quality, like, digital wallets in the space, whether it's, you know, mobile or it's hardware wallets. Would love for you to expand upon that point of like why a digital wallet might be the next brokerage account and kind of what that means for the average person as well as for, you know, different companies in the space as well.
Yeah, look, I think that there's two key pieces here, right? So one is most of the people in crypto today are technologists, and they're looking at the world from a technologist lens. So they're talking about all of the interesting things that are being built as kind of the infrastructure or the underlying layer to the consumer layer, right? Actually, what we believe is that users are going to drive the adoption, right? So the example I always give is, do the mass consumers actually care whether Facebook is decentralized or not? Probably not, right? There is some subset of people that care. But for the most part, people just want, what is the service that has the most users, that brings me the most value, is the best product, is the fastest, right, is available, you know, all of these things. And so when you look at from a global consumer standpoint, you have to have a great user experience, right? That is what drives adoption. And so if you look at what is going to be the interface for majority of those people to interact with blockchain and cryptocurrencies and digital assets, it's going to be through that digital wallet. Right. And so it's kind of the entry point, if you will. And so just like a brokerage account is the entry point to buying and selling securities, right, or a bank account is an entry point into the financial system, that digital wallet is the entry point into this whole digital world. Right. And so when you get a digital wallet that serves as both a brokerage account and a bank account, right, because you can hold currencies, commodities, stocks, bonds, et cetera, all in one single location. Now, all of a sudden, you can really do interesting things on a global scale because everything is digitized. There becomes more automation through smart contracts, right? Everything is more secure and audited, zero knowledge proofs, et cetera. And so I think that that's got to be one of the big focuses here is, let's get the best digital wallets available to consumers, get them onboarded into this environment. And then from there, we can go, you know, wild and build all the things I think everyone's excited about.
Totally. And I think you make a great point too, initially speaking. Like, I've kind of long had that opinion. I feel like, especially during the crazy kind of mania in December, January, November, whatever it was. But just a lot of people are talking about, oh my God, you know, whatever dApp is going to be the best thing since sliced bread. And just the user experience is nowhere near there. And there's really no reason for, outside of the, you know, 0.1% of people that are really into this stuff, like, why they would use some type of decentralized alternative to Facebook or to Twitter or to something else like that if nobody else is on it, if nobody else is using it, if it's a pain in the ass to use. So I think that's, yeah, I mean, I've always kind of thought, at least in my mind, like, until a decentralized product or service is on par or better than the centralized alternative from a UI perspective, you're never going to see that adoption.
Yeah. So 2 points on that, right? One is like, it's kind of like dial-up. Everyone used dial-up because that was the best available, but everyone hated it. No one liked sitting there while it actually went through the process of connecting to the internet. And so the second something else was available, we used a different piece of technology, right? And because it was better, right? It was faster, all this stuff. Now, if you look at these decentralized applications and kind of the entire user experience, I've been pushing a lot of teams. I don't care whether you're decentralized or not, right? Not because I don't think it's important. I actually think it's very important, right? I don't think the user cares. And so what you've got to do is you've got to come to market with a product that people want to use without knowing that it's decentralized, right? And then when they find out that it's decentralized, they fall even more in love with you, right? But if they don't love your product without knowing that it's decentralized, it's not good enough. Yeah. And so I think that's like that bar of quality is really hard to meet, because now you just get into, you're building consumer products, right? And you got to be a great consumer product company in order to just have a chance. And then decentralization gives you an extra advantage once people already like or love your product. So I think that gets lost a lot, because decentralization is so important to this subset of individuals working on this stuff that we forget the mass consumer doesn't really care, right? And so as long as we can remember that, I think those are the teams that are going to really build the valuable things that everyone uses. And frankly, look at the largest companies in the space. Bitmain, Coinbase, Circle, et cetera, they're not decentralized, yeah, right? But they are the best products on the market. And so could they decentralize in the future? Maybe, right? It doesn't make sense from a business perspective. Maybe. I don't know. But we know that they're valuable because consumers want to use them regardless of if they're decentralized or not.
Yeah, that's, I mean, I think I'm pretty much fully in agreement with that, especially too. I mean, Coinbase is a great example of that. You know, it's a product for the most part that your grandma could use if she wanted to buy or sell Bitcoin or crypto or whatever it might be. So I think that's definitely a great point. One thing I think that probably everybody knows you for is tokenizing the world. Why are you so passionate? First of all, maybe what does tokenizing the world mean? And like, why are you so passionate about that in particular?
Yeah, so to clarify, so tokenize the world, I randomly tweeted it one day. Look, I figured Twitter out, right? And I know kind of the things that I can say that will kind of rally people up and get them excited. So one of the parts of this whole movement or revolution that I think is really important is most people are building amazing technology. But for the most part, the crypto markets and the crypto industry is doing a horrible job of telling that story to the mass consumer and kind of the broader world. Right. And so a lot of times, people will accuse me of, listen, you use really simple language, or, you're taking something that's really complex and valuable, et cetera, and you're boiling it down to something that, almost cheapens what it is. And part of that is you have to speak in the language of those that you're speaking to. Right. It's just human psychology and communication and marketing. And so, I think that gets lost a lot of times because we're so deep in the weeds. Right. And so tokenize the world is one of those attempts of, how do you describe to somebody this world of, all right, if the interface to digital world and cryptocurrency and blockchain, et cetera, is this digital wallet, well, then every asset that you interact with or hold in that digital wallet has to be digitized, right? That's the only way that it interacts. And so just like if I buy stock in a company, the brokerage account that I have has to support that type of technology or that format. Same thing in the digital world. If I have a digital wallet, I can't hold a stock from the New York Stock Exchange in my digital wallet. So I need to digitize it to actually be able to hold it there, right? And so it's really hard to tell that story in 280 characters, let alone three words. Yeah. And so that's where I came up with, tokenize the world. Basically, it's just let's make everything digital so that then we can have this kind of seamless interaction, this seamless consumer experience and interface. Now, tokenize the world is really catchy. It explodes. And I think a bunch of people have kind of run with it and turned it into, to mean different things for different people, which is kind of the power of, this open source community and this online audience. But I think it's a really strong rallying cry around, we need to get things into a digital format in order for us to make this entire system work. And so tokenizing or digitizing those things, literally the world, right, allows us to do that.
And in regards to tokenizing things, I know just from hearing you speak at different conferences and things like that, you very much believe in Bitcoin. You very much believe in security tokens or digital securities or whatever, terminology you want to use there, and not so much in utility tokens or consumer tokens or whatever it might be. Outside of utility tokens and consumer tokens, which I know you're not too big on, would love to hear, you know, why you are a fan of Bitcoin and why you really believe in the security token or digital security space as well.
Yeah, so Bitcoin's easy, right? I think that the three things that really kind of get me excited are the economic model is very attractive, right? I think a lot of people call it like sound money, right? Yeah. So I think that's one. Two is the idea that you can't kill it, right? So very anti-fragile. And even if a government with the largest army in the world tries to kill it, they cannot kill it, right? So I think that's really important. And then I think to kind of tangentially related is it's censorship resistant. Right. And so, what you end up doing is you end up having the code govern and the rules that are set. The market will decide, does this have value or not? So far, the market has told us, hey, look, this is really attractive. And a lot of people are buying into that governance. Right. It's the same thing like with a human based government or monetary system, et cetera. The people buy into it. Right. There have been plenty of times in history where people said, look, we don't agree with our government structure anymore, or we don't agree with whatever, and they revolt. And so what we're seeing here is people are buying into an economic model and a code of governance that is attractive. And so the market is responding and deriving value or putting value on this. So it continues to appreciate in value. So I think that's interesting. On the digital security side, it's not so much the security element, right? It's the digitization. We live in 2018, and if we're going to go forward into 40, 50, 60s, what we need is we need things that are all able to interface with each other in a digital world. And so that's securities, that's utilities, that's money, that's everything in the world needs to become digitized so that there's one seamless system, right? Now, on the utility versus the security side, the securities are much more interesting to me because as an investor, what I see is when I give you money, I'm receiving equity, debt, or cash flows. Right. And so that's a very easy construct for me and my investors is to say, hey, I give you money. Here's how I make money back. That is my job, right? Is to make money for our investors. And so if I give you money and you say, I'm giving you this thing, and the only thing that is going to possibly make you money is that the asset is going to appreciate, but you have no recourse. You have no claim on equity, debt, cash flow, et cetera. It's a really hard sell to myself and to our investors, right? So it doesn't mean that that's not valuable. It's just not as interesting to me as the thing that allows me to do my job well, right? So I think sure. That's one. On the utility side, the other piece of this is I think right now a lot of people are trying to use the technology, but they're not coming at it from the consumer's perspective. So if you look at most of the utility tokens that are out there, one, they were a fundraising mechanism, or two is we basically took something that didn't have a utility token or some business model, et cetera, and we're now adding in this utility token as payment rails, et cetera. I think that there's just, it's a little lazy in some regards, right? That sure. People are just, that's the default. And so what I think is going to end up happening here is people are going to have to be more, to think more critically about how do we actually use a utility token to incentivize human behavior in a way that has a long-term sustainability and repeatability rather than just kind of slap it on any type of product or service.
Yeah, I think those are really excellent points too. And I mean, I think that's one of the issues that we're seeing now with these utility tokens is, like you said, the vast majority were kind of really for a fundraising mechanism, and kind of the actual utility or utilization of the token within the ecosystem was kind of an afterthought. And I think now a lot of people are trying to figure that out, kind of post launch or after the actual fundraising has occurred and realizing maybe the model isn't as ideal as they thought it were, is simply using it as a payment mechanism within an application that may or may not have a lot of use is not the best way to go through things. So I think those are really, really strong points.
And here's an interesting construct that I've been using. So previously, I think that the power in the fundraising environment had shifted to investors. Right? There's more companies that want capital than there are investors who are willing to put that capital into the companies. Mm-hmm. So in that regard, the investors have power on an aggregate scale, right? What we just saw was a flip or a reverse of that power structure. Founders could now come out and raise capital from anybody in the world. So now there's more investors willing to put money in than there are opportunities, right? And then founders start to drive the economic deals. So you saw founders raising money with no dilution, It's a fantastic deal. And for a founder,
yeah,
all of the incentives from an individual basis are pointing them towards doing this, right? So if you think about, we were over-rotated to the investors. Now we just over-rotated to the founders. What I think ends up happening here is we get some equilibrium, right? We kind of come back to center, and there's more kind of equal power between the investor and the founder, which not only allows for more investors to participate, right? So we'll continue to see that higher degree of investor participation, but also founders are going to have to give up the idea of non-dilutive capital and things like that. And so, again, the best deals or best negotiations are where both sides leave something on the table, right? They feel like it was a pretty good deal, but it wasn't the best possible deal, right? No one got screwed. So I think that's what we're seeing, is we're seeing a consolidation of power from both founders and investors. And we're going to get this area where they're like, okay, fair deals are being done, but no one's walking away with an outsized advantage out of those deals.
And one thing you had mentioned was kind of the ability to raise, outside just the non-dilutive aspect, was the ability to raise capital initially, at least within an ICO or an initial coin offering or a token sale, whatever anybody wants to call it, was the ability to raise capital from really anyone, anywhere, which was pretty interesting, at least I thought initially, regardless of the actual use case behind it. And now it is kind of limited, really, in the most sense, to accredited investors. And I know you had tweeted about this recently. I was actually talking about this last night with someone. I'm kind of fully in agreement, but would love to have you talk a little bit about just your thoughts on the accredited investor regulations in the United States, at least.
Look, I am many of the people in my family, right, are immigrants to the United States. I come from an Italian and Cuban background. My longtime girlfriend is an immigrant, and so is her entire family. And so I think that part of the draw for people around the world to come to the United States is this idea of the American dream and capitalism, right? That no matter who you are, where you're from, where you were born, what language you speak, what your financial means are, when you show up to this country, you have the ability to make a life for yourself, right? And so we have these laws, which are the accreditation laws, that are in direct conflict with the American dream. And what they state are, unless you have a preset amount of financial wherewithal, you cannot participate in the highest yielding investment opportunities that are available to citizens of the United States, right? To make no kind of disconnect here, accreditation laws are nothing more than the ability for the rich to get richer, right? It's literally written into law. You cannot invest in this unless you are rich. And so with that, what I think we need to move to, right, is a system that is not based on financial means, but is rather based on financial knowledge. Right. And so here's the example. So a lot of people say, well, accreditation is important because that means that those people can withstand the ability to lose some money. Right. Accreditation does not say if you have $2 million, you can't go put $2 million in one investment. Right. There's no kind of safeguards. It just says you somehow got $2 million. So you must be smart enough to make these investments. Right. We allow people who are not accredited to gamble, to buy lottery tickets, to do all these other things. Right. But the things that are probably the better investment rather than gambling and lottery tickets, they are precluded from doing. And so I think that, in the past, I would probably even argue that financial means was the best thing that we had, right? There wasn't a ton of access to information. It was the best way to get a lot of people to kind of be allowed to invest in these opportunities. Now we have access to information. We've got the ability to kind of test people at scale and do it in a really kind of thoughtful, compliant way, et cetera. We should move from the accreditation being based on financial wealth and move to it being based on knowledge. And if we do a good job educating people and making sure that they're actually sophisticated before they invest in these opportunities, my guess is that we will have more sound investments, and actually we will save a lot of those rich people from losing all their money.
Yeah.
So it kind of helps on both sides here. But ultimately, I think I'm just a big believer in the American dream. And if we have laws on the books that are preventing that, we need to address that, right? So that we can go ahead and continue to fuel a lot of what brings people to this country.
Yeah, I'm in agreement with that, I think. And I think I feel like most people would be in, and the counter debate to that is, know, there are people with not enough means that shouldn't be risking their money or in certain aspects. But in the most part, like even just getting a chance to interact in some of these, you know, opportunities or see some of these accredited deals, you realize how good of an opportunity the vast majority of some of these, you know, accredited only opportunities are for people. And it is in the vast majority of cases, the rich get richer, and you know, you don't have someone who's not accredited does not have that opportunity.
I tell my partners a lot. I know a lot of dumb rich people, right? There's a lot of dumb rich people in the world, and so just because you're rich doesn't mean that you're smart. But look, you know, it's another thing. You know, we're making an announcement today that we invested in Cityblock Capital, right? Yeah. And so. One of the things that's interesting there, so Cityblock is they're basically building a venture capital firm from scratch for the digital age, right? And so this idea that within the U.S. laws, they will allow more people to participate in the asset class of venture capital, right? So people can send in either fiat or digital currency, and they can be from both domestic or international investors that are regulatory compliant, and they can now get access to this asset class. But the capital is being deployed by people who have a high degree of knowledge, experience, right, and networks. And so there's a lot of people who actually probably shouldn't make these investments themselves. What they should be allowed to do is they should be allowed to give that money to professionals, right? But today, in order to get into a venture fund in the United States, you have to be rich, you've got to be well-connected, right? And then you've got to somehow get access to the right people to get into those venture funds, right? I think that what Cityblock is doing and what got us excited about it is they're breaking down the barriers to people participating in this asset class, and they're doing it in a way that is compelling to digital natives and going to interface well with this digital world. And so, you know, we made that investment, and I think that we're going to continue to make investments in this space because it's all interrelated, right? The consumer experiences, the accreditation laws, the kind of digital age, right? All of this stuff is moving really, really fast. And I said it the other day on Twitter, and I got some backlash for it, but look, technologists are conducting a full-on assault on the financial world, right? No one is safe. This is exchanges, brokers, banks, right? Advisors, I mean, just everything is under attack. And it's not because, you know, I think a lot of people, they're fraudulent, they're all this stuff. That all helps, right? That gets people, you know, mad and they want to change it. But what's actually occurring here is people want more efficient, better user experiences, right? And so technologists can create that, and they are, and they're going up and they're competing against these incumbent, you know, financial service companies, and the incumbents stand no chance over a long period of time, right? And so that's what I think is really exciting about this entire thing is just you're taking people with a certain set of skills and experiences, and they're going head on with a group of people that have dominated the world for a long period of time, but they don't have the skills and experiences to kind of fight back in this digital world. And so I think that, you know, I kind of have already got this foregone conclusion in my head of how this plays out. And frankly, I think it's the technologists building, you know, a new digital financial world.
Yeah, I think that's a great point too. And going to the initial thing in Cityblock Capital too. I mean, I think that model on their end is really interesting, especially like you said, when, you know, they're raising capital and having the guys from CoVenture, Nikhil Atit and the CoVenture VC team to deploy that capital. And there'll be a video on the channel, I think later this week or next week, where I actually spoke to them. And you know, when you get a chance to speak to somebody like that and kind of learn their background and you know, see the types of, even if you're an accredited investor, you know, you're never going to see that type of deal flow that somebody like Nikhil would, unless you're, you know, already basically a VC, you're never going to see that type of deal flow that somebody like Nikhil might see. So having the opportunity to kind of invest in, you know, in a space like that is, I think it's pretty, pretty interesting and pretty appealing. And one of the reasons I'm kind of excited to work with those guys is as well. But yeah, that's, I think those are, you know, those are really strong points about the incumbents.
It's like
too.
A surgeon, right? I use the surgeon example a lot, right? So I don't conduct surgery on myself or any of my friends because one, I'm not allowed to, but even if I was allowed to, right? I don't have the information, I don't have the experience, and I don't work on it full time, right? Yep. I'm not a surgeon. So therefore I shouldn't conduct surgery. It's the same thing with investing, right? If you don't have the knowledge, if you don't have the experience, if you don't have the deal flow, and you don't do it full time, you probably are not better suited than a professional investor to invest capital, right? Now, you got to pick the right professional investor. Just because you spend a full time on something doesn't mean you're good, right? But I think that a lot of times ego gets in the way, right? And kind of this sensationalization or we've made it sexy, right? To be an angel investor and all this stuff. And you're right. There are people who have hit it big, right? The Chris Sacca's, the Jason Calacanis's, like they've done fantastic for themselves. But for every one of those, there's hundreds of people who have lost money, right? And so I think that somebody has to sit down and really be honest with themselves and kind of have that intellectual honesty to say, look, am I good enough to beat the professionals? There's very few things in the world that I think I can beat professionals at, right? I can't actually even think of one off the top of my head. And so why do I think I'm going to do that in professional investing? I'm not, right? Or I'm going to go become a professional. And so I think that's part of the beauty of the city block model is if most people come to the conclusion, I'm not a professional and therefore I can't invest better than the professionals. Okay, I need to go find one. I think that stops a lot of people. Where do they go? Right. And so this model allows them to give the money to professionals, have the transparency of information, et cetera. And so I think it's just really, really exciting, as this digital world's getting built, to have somebody trying to build, you know, this new type of financial service company, a venture capital fund, specifically for, that digital world.
Totally. Yeah, that's, I think it's kind of, in a lot of ways, democratizes the venture capital world within, the confines of existing regulation and, making sure that, they're able to give as many people access to that as possible, which is pretty damn cool with, like we talked about too. I mean, getting the highest quality, what really matters is what you're investing in and having high quality people behind it, driving that is pretty cool. Finishing off here, I think, maybe the last question we can kick off with is, what are you most excited about in the crypto or blockchain world within like the next 3 to 6 months? Is there anything, whether it's projects or trends or anything like that, that you're just like really fascinated by or excited to see within like the next 3 to 6 months?
Yeah, so I think there's a couple of things. One, Bitcoin, right? I think that we are, well, myself and Jason and Mark, both my partners, we're all in, right? I think that we truly have bought into the idea that this is a better economic model for money, right? And I think that we have long-term conviction in the continued ability for that asset to rise in price, because we think more and more people will learn about it, become educated, and come to the same conclusion, right? And therefore more people come into a system. And so I think that's one for sure. Two is the digital wallets, right? So I think that is a huge piece of this is, what does that consumer interface look like to the digital world? And then three is, what I would consider all of the products and services that are going to get built in the digital world, right? So tokenized securities, right, is basically just digitizing all of the securities, right? If you look at, the financial service companies, right? So all of those now have to build for a digital world. If you look out at, data, right? So the data world is really interesting to me in that now all of a sudden what we're able to do is we're able to get new sets of data that we've never had access to before. Right. There's a lot of financial decisions. So here's a couple of examples. There's a lot of financial systems that are a lot of financial decisions that are still occurring because people are doing surveys. And like, yeah, I get it. Right. That there's some statistical significance and we've got a pretty good idea of how surveys work. But if you ever ask somebody, how many times a week do you go to the gym? It's not very accurate. Right. And so there's just it's inherently flawed when you ask people to self-report things. Right. And so if that's the kind of bar for the quality of data that decisions are being based on, I think we can do better, right? And so there's this whole world as we go into a digital, ecosystem and world that we're going to have better data sets, which then should lead to better decision making, right? And then the second thing is, I remember hearing a story. There was hedge funds that were flying like helicopters or planes or something, and I think they were looking at like oil tanks somewhere in the middle in the Midwest. Right. And they were trying to gauge how much oil and to predict, all kinds of stuff, or they take pictures of like the number of cars in the Walmart parking lot and, all kinds of stuff they're doing. Like, we can do better. Right. Yeah. And that's a huge segment. And so not only is it the data sources, but then it's what gets built on top of those data sources, right? And so can you start to automate things and stuff like that? And so here's where it kind of comes full circle is I think that there is a world where the digital wallet is the interface into this digital world, right? You then have all the digital securities that are being bought and sold, right? So there's all these assets. And then you're going to get like the robotics automation, right? You know, the interface with the human brain, all this stuff is going to also kind of get melded in. And you're going to start to see just a more efficient system. That vision is going to take 20, 30, 40 years to come to fruition. But today where we stand, we're starting to see the beginning of it, right? Yeah. Because we're seeing things get built. And so for us, this is a really, really long-term play, right? I think there's a lot of people who are kind of looking at how do I hit my quarterly number and my trading? Look, good luck, right? You're not going to see us kind of, you know, living and dying by those quarterly reports because we've got this really long vision of what world is going to get created. And so we want to invest in the opportunities or the teams that are building, you know, kind of the pillars of that today. And over time, kind of the additional layer of the products and services on top of it.
Yeah, that's I think that's a really interesting outlook, and you know, kind of separating from like the it's pretty damn difficult, and I think it takes a lot of foresight and a lot of vision to actually do that. But like separating from the very near term and going kind of far out beyond and having that type of foresight, I don't have it. I sure shit don't have it. But to speak with somebody that's kind of looking at it in that lens is pretty awesome. But finishing up here, really do appreciate the time today. It was awesome to speak with you. If anybody is looking for you online, I have the Twitter handle right above. I'm sure you're already following him anyway. But anything you want to sign off with?
Nah, man. Listen, just Twitter is the best place to follow. I appreciate you taking the time to do this. I think this is super valuable to the community. And look, the part that is probably the most help that I can provide is if people are interested in the stuff that we're talking about, just reach out, right? I think we're trying to be as accessible as possible. And frankly, I want to hear from people who, want to agree with us, but also probably want to even hear more from the people who disagree with us, right? Yeah. And there's things that we've kind of taken a position on and then had people who are way smarter than us, kind of school us on those, kind of intricacies and we reverse our opinion. And so that's the beauty of this entire space is that, people are not shy to share their opinions, especially when they disagree with you, right?
Definitely not.
we're out there. We're public on Twitter, and let's go at it.
Awesome. Well, appreciate the time. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Appreciate it, man.